The Senate Revenue Committee for April the 2nd. We would like to do the reconsiderations on 550 and 819 as soon as we get...
Do we have four? Four votes?
Oh, we can do them. We can do them.
With four votes?
Yeah, let's do them.
You've got the scripts.
Oh. Open work session.
So we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 550.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 550.
Senator Starr has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 550. Those of the opinion that the rules should be suspended and for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 550 will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Tara, who is back and healthy, will call the roll.
We're doing 550.
First. Yeah.
Aye.
Just the Hanford Memorial?
Reconsider and vote effect.
This is rural school funding bill. You'll love it.
Well, I'm not going to vote until I know what I'm voting on. This is bringing 550 back.
What if you have a change of mind?
It's a rules
suspension.
We're bringing the bill back. 550. We're going to reconsider it. She just called you.
No.
Is this on?
Yes.
Aye.
Are you on?
Aye.
Thank you.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 550 was sent to the floor with the due pass as amended recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 550 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Any discussion from the committee? Those opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 550 was sent to the floor will pass. Will say aye. Those opposed, no. Tara will call the roll.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Now, do we need to reconsider the dash three amendments?
Yes, we do.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 550-3 amendments were adopted.
Senator Starr has moved that we reconsider the vote by which the Senate Bill 550-3 amendments were adopted. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
What's the reason for doing this?
The reason, and maybe we'll, if we could have someone from the Department of Education come up. The chief reason, as we remember, when we passed this bill to the floor, it had no fiscal. And so subsequently, it received about a $250,000 fiscal attached to it, which then the president's office asked us to bring the bill back and reconsider based on the fiscal. Mr. Warner and the department have met subsequently and have worked out the fiscal, and maybe they can report where we're at in terms of our fiscal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Seward from the Reagan Department of Education. We encountered, as this bill passed through the committee, sort of the failure of one arm of the department communicating with the other. What happened was that one office in the department prepared a fiscal statement without full information about what another department was doing in terms of the data collection and the management of data and the reporting of data that was already occurring, so that some of the majority of the fiscal statement was under the belief that we had to create those systems. In fact, they do exist. So that takes care of the majority of the fiscal amount of money that was in that fiscal statement, the $280,000 or $250,000, which leaves us with actually a small amount of effort that we need to put in to collect the data in order to distribute the dollars under the formula that is in the bill, and that those efforts can be absorbed by the Department of Education and the Office of Special Ed, where I am the Associate Superintendent.
Okay. So we have no fiscal.
We have no fiscal.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, if we adopt the dash four, there's no fiscal. Thank you, Mr. Warner, for facilitating that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr has moved that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 550-3 amendments were adopted. Any further discussion? Those of opinion that we should reconsider will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Tara?
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
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 Motion passes. So we have the bill back before us. If the committee would like to move the bill, we would need to adopt the dash 4 and then send it back onto the floor without a fiscal.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I'd move the dash 4 amendment to
Wait,
Senate.
Let me get the dash 4.
Yeah. Can we look at the dash 4, Mr. Chairman?
No. This is all in shape. I figured we got the dash 4.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Can you do the motion?
Sure.
To bring it back?
Sure.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the dash 4 has one technical correction to it that makes it different from the dash 3. On the first page, in sections 2, it clarifies that the four times language is to be four times the general purpose grant per extended ADMW. As it was drafted before, there was some uncertainty as to whether the four times was times the double weight or a single weight. And it was always intended to be times a single weight, and this clarifies that.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, are we in work session? I move the dash 4 as be adopted, Mr. Chairman, into Senate Bill 550.
Senator Farrelly has moved the dash 4 to Senate Bill 550. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move 550 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Can we check with Senator Corcoran? I know he's just stepped out. He's in the...
He's just walking, Mr.
Chairman. That's okay. Senator Farrelly has moved Senate Bill 550 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Comments? By time for Senator Corcoran if he is close by. Tara, please call the roll.
Senator
Jarndale?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Is an aye. The bill passes to the floor, and we will keep the same carrier as we had last time. You ready to do 819?
I'd prefer that Mr. Hannon be here.
Okay. Cool.
Senator Hannon.
When Senator Hannon arrives, we will do Senate Bill 819. We'll bring it back to committee. So we will start in on our public hearings on tax credit. Today is our tax credit day. Our first day we've looked at tax credits. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 292. Senator Farrelly, if you would like to introduce a bill that you first passed a few sessions back.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senate Bill 292 is what I think is an excellent opportunity to allow high technology businesses in the state of Oregon to assist the education system in Oregon by donating equipment to the school system from kindergarten all the way through higher education. And the bill before us simply builds on that good work by allowing a sunset date to be extended through 2010. I think there are some folks here from the AEA that will testify to the accomplishments that this tax credit has facilitated in terms of donations to school districts. It's been quite significant, perhaps more than we even anticipated in the original bill, and has become the basis for the transfer of some wonderful technology to communities and schools that otherwise would not be able to buy the equipment or have it in any other way. It's an investment, obviously, by the state in the form of a tax credit, but it is paying great dividends to the local communities. And it solves problems for industry, and it certainly solves problems for the education community. So I would simply urge the committee to listen carefully to the members of the AEA about their goals and what this bill has accomplished in the years that it's been on the books.
Thank you. Liz Beth, anything that you might add to...
As Chairman Jeckard and Senators, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. I'll just point you to the staff measure summary on the history of this bill, just so everyone's clear. Basically, it was enacted in 1985, and basically you can get a credit against your corporate income taxes for contributions of computers and scientific equipment or a research donation to an institution of higher education, post-secondary school, or Oregon Public School. In addition, donations of money under a contract for scientific or engineering research or donations of a contract for maintenance of computers or scientific equipment can also qualify for the credit. The credit is basically equal to 10% of the fair market value of the equipment that is donated, and it can be carried forward for 5 years. Under current law, as Senator Ferrioli just said, it's to sunset on January 1st, 2004. In tax year 1999 and 2000, there were less than 5 corporations that utilized the credit. The amount of reduction was minimal. It was $193,000 reduction in 1999, less than $50,000 in 2000. So the revenue impact is really not significant. It will reduce income tax revenues by $50,000 in 2004-05 and roughly $100,000 per biennium after that.
Question.
Senator Starr.
Is there a cap on the total credit that can be claimed?
Senator Starr, no, that's just the 10% of the fair market value of the equipment, so it's just a function of the equipment.
Thank you.
AEA and Deans, Adams.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the Oregon Council of the American Electronics Association. I think your staff did an excellent job, and Senator Ferrioli did an excellent job of outlining what is really a pretty modest proposal before you today. A couple comments about the nature of this credit, which I think your staff did mention. I just want to reiterate that this is only for new equipment. This is I've had a lot of questions about that, about whether this is a way to get rid of your surplus stuff, but it is new equipment only. So this is not for surplus or used. The credit is only for corporations who donate basically brand new out of the box computers or other scientific equipment to educational institutions. Again, as been mentioned, it is 10% of the fair market value. And another thing just to mention that it is you must take this either or, a credit or a deduction. There's not a doubling up here. And in some companies, when they're doing their tax planning, as you know in your own personal life, you know, sometimes you take a deduction, sometimes there's a credit. People have that choice, but it's either or, and that's specified in the statute, that it's not on top of, say, a charitable deduction you've already taken on your income tax. In the Oregon Tax Expenditure Report for this session, there's a quote when this credit was analyzed that basically says this is a fiscally effective method of achieving the goal of the program of this provision. This tax incentive appears to be much less costly than when educational organizations have to purchase such equipment outright. And that's pretty obvious. Free is always a good price for just about anything. So this is one of the tax credits I think you can be assured that absolutely addresses its goal. No contribution, no tax credit. This is not something where someone could argue that someone's getting a tax credit for not doing explicitly what the statute tries to encourage people to do. If you give something, there's a tax credit. If you don't, there isn't. I think it's been over the years, we've seen that it provides a tool for the campuses, and I'll let them speak for themselves, but it is a tool, particularly in looking at major donations, that particularly a university and looking for a contribution of equipment, can use this as a tool to say, you know, there is it's sort of a pot sweetener in terms of for the company's position to look at the value of a credit in figuring out how much they can give and the range of giving that they can afford. And just to reiterate that the value proposition of this one is always on the side of the recipient. You know, 100%. The recipient, whether it's a K through 12 school or university, they get 100% of the value of this donation. The company may or may not choose to take this credit, and that it's limited to 10% of the fair market value. I think I would argue that in these times with what we're doing in higher education, particularly with the really exciting new Kelly Engineering Center at Oregon State University, with the following right on its heels, a new engineering center at Portland State, with the big capital expansion going on at Oregon Health Sciences University and those projects, you know, the challenge of building the building is only one thing. You put up the building, then you've got to equip it. And I guess I would argue that even if this wasn't just an extension of a sunset date, if this was a brand new bill, that it would make sense in these times, because these are big challenges. General fund is lacking in terms of allocating dollars to these institutions to go out and buy expensive equipment, and this is one tool that'll help them go out and solicit equipment for the new engineering centers that are going up in the state. In the past, I just want to mention a couple, a number of the companies who have communicated to me about making such donations and using this credit in the past. Hewlett-Packard Company, Intel, Tektronix, InFocus, IBM, Orcad, LSI Logic, Planar, Credence, and others. And some of the recipients include Portland State, Oregon State, University of Oregon, OIT, OGI, Portland Community College, Blue Mountain Community College, Chemeketa Community College, George Fox, and Linfield. Just to point out that at least at the higher ed level, this is not just for public institutions. It also covers private institutions of higher education. So that's my pitch. And here with me today are our two engineering deans, Dean Ron Adams from Oregon State University and Dean Bob Dryden from Portland State University, and this is really something for them more than it is for us. So I'll let Ron.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Adams. I'm Dean of Engineering at Oregon State, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about this, I think, very important bill. Also, thank you for all the efforts that you have provided on our behalf in the past and also the future prospects. As you know, what we're about at Oregon State and Portland State and elsewhere across the state is building both capacity and quality in our engineering programs, and I think you also know that's being directed by the Engineering and Technology Industry Council, with a goal to both double the number of graduates and also increase the quality and ranking, national ranking of the programs. And you've all heard that Oregon State is out to build a top 25 engineering school for Oregon, and we have been making great progress. You also may recall that we're seeking $180 million total investment to accomplish that task. And thus far, we have exceeded $85 million in combined public and private investment. And what you need to know is that those public dollars have been leveraged 2-to-1. So every dollar from the state has been leveraged by $2 in private contributions. And probably the largest example of a project there is the $45 million Kelly Engineering Center that we're about to begin construction. The result of those investments has enabled us to double the number of top students coming into our program as freshmen. We've successfully competed against schools like MIT and Cornell in attracting them to Oregon State and keeping them within the state of Oregon. The other thing it's enabled us to do is attract top professors, innovate our curriculum, and nearly double our research. And that research is beginning to have impact. In fact, there was recent news about the invention of a transparent transistor, and the net of that is it enables new kinds of display devices. There is an Oregon company that's very interested in that working with us. So our goals, as you heard, are to increase the number and quality of graduates and also to develop high-impact research results that have an impact on Oregon's economy. And Senate Bill 292 is a bill that will enable us to continue to do that in the following way. For example, if you look at just the current biennium, and I'm going to give you numbers as of January of this year, we've had a total of about $10 million in private donations, and about 25% of that is in equipment donations. And inside of that equipment is $1.2 million from Hewlett-Packard for computing, networking, and optoelectronics research equipment, $500,000 from Intel to create a mobile wireless network across the entire engineering complex, and that includes the new Kelly Engineering Center, and about $250,000 from Tektronix for test and measurement equipment, about $250,000 from Sun Microsystems for workstations, and nearly $200,000 from ESI for laser micro machining equipment. And you'll learn as we go through the process that that has an impact on a new signature research center for Oregon called the Multiscale Materials and Devices Center. These donations have enabled us to improve our undergraduate laboratories. We are receiving cutting-edge equipment from these companies, so it keeps our students on the leading edge. They've also enabled us to advance our key research programs, and we have in the handout a leaf here are some details about what some of these items are. As we look forward to the next biennium, you will, as you heard earlier, from Jim Craven, we will be looking to equip the Kelly Engineering Center as well as to continue to advance the state of the art of the equipment in our facilities. We have a proposal from the Engineering and Technology Industry Council that amounts to a $40 million investment this biennium. Included in that is $17 million for OSU's Top 25 initiative, and we're expecting about 20% of the $34 million in private funds we will raise will be in the form of equipment for the Kelly Center and other expansions. So the bottom line is that this has served us well, this idea has served us well, and we strongly encourage your continuation of the incentive and at all levels of education, because I think it's important that young people and of all ages have access to the cutting-edge technology that they will work with later in life. Thank you.
Thank you. Dean Dryden.
Chairman Deckert and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Dryden. I'm Dean of Engineering and Computer Science at Portland State University, and I also would like to express my appreciation for your willingness to let us talk on behalf of this bill. It is something that directly affects engineering education in the state of Oregon, and we might take a historical look. There have been two things that have changed most dramatically in engineering education, and one has to do with the price of the equipment that goes into the laboratories that we educate our students with, and the other is the obsolescence cycle. It wasn't so many years ago that we would get equipment government surplus and use that equipment for 15 to 25 years. At the present time, we get equipment not in the thousands of dollars, but cost millions of dollars, and we use that equipment for 3 years, and then it becomes obsolete. So it's essential that the laboratories, in order to have credibility with industry and to provide the education that the students need so that they can hit the ground running after they graduate and be prepared for the assignments that they will get, that they be educated with the state-of-the-art equipment. At Portland State, engineering, technology, and science have been allocated a priority, and in that priority came the mandate to upgrade and expand the laboratories to assure that the state-of-the-art equipment existed. It was at that point that a partnership existed between industry and the university, as well as the legislature, to help with this upgrading of these facilities. It was necessary that the students have access and the proper amounts of the proper kinds of equipment so that the Oregonians could be educated in the kinds of to pursue the kinds of jobs that were available in the state. With this goal came the opportunity for us to take a close look at what needs to be done. And Dean Adams and I
have looked, and we've made sure that what we provide is not a duplicative situation of equipment and laboratories, but rather a supportive set of laboratories. He mentioned some of the laboratories at Oregon State. I might want to mention that we have an integrated circuits design and test lab, which has over $2 million worth of equipment. This laboratory has a couple of distinctions associated with it. One, it's remotely accessible, so wherever a computer circuit is designed, it can be tested in the laboratory at Portland State without the person doing the test ever leaving their desk, and the information can be downloaded. Also, it's important to note that over $2 million donation in equipment came from Credence, and that was the first donation Credence had ever made to an academic institution. So we're very pleased with the opportunity to partner with industries such as this to provide the kinds of education that our students need to pursue the highest level of jobs. Another laboratory that has been implemented is a chemical mechanical planarization laboratory that works with wafers, so that we can put more components on a chip than had previously been done. There are four laboratories like this in the country. Three of those are on the East Coast, and the laboratory we have at Portland State. So what is happening with the equipment that has been given is that our students are assured that the jobs that they will pursue after graduation will have the education necessary and will be prepared to pursue those. We have so far in this biennium about $2.5 million donation of equipment to engineering, and about $3.5 million more to the university for science and technology as well. We are currently discussing donations of around $500,000 for engineering, maybe $1 million for the university. That should come to closure before the end of this biennium. So it is very significant, the amount of effort and the amount of support that industry has provided to our university. And we're very pleased to be able to have a partnership with the legislature, with the university, and with the industry here in the state to assure that our educational system is the best that it can possibly be. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jim Craven for the record. I just not wanting to leave out the third of our esteemed troika. I have a letter here I'll give to your assistant from President Dave Frohmeyer from the University of Oregon, also in support of the bill, and I'll just read two sentences from it. The University of Oregon benefits greatly from its partnership with Oregon industry and from the generosity of companies that donate much-needed equipment. We applaud all efforts to make this generosity as easy and as cost-effective as possible. And he goes on to mention some further examples of other laboratories that have been equipped at University of Oregon. So, a letter from President Frohmeyer.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
Elizabeth, do you have a more accurate revenue update on this? It only has $99,200. It says less than 5% or 5 corporations annually utilize this tax credit. If only 5 corporations are utilizing it, is it really to the extent that I know 5 corporations, there's other corporations that are involved in electronics that might have an impact in Oregon besides 5, or is this the 5 that have an impact in Oregon?
Chairman Deckard and Senator Hannon, this really is all the information I have. I mean, it is really sparse as far as the information that we have. And we rely on the Department of Revenue's tax data, and the most recent tax data we have is 2000. So, you know, when the information that, like, we're getting today, you know, with from these different universities is really more up to date than what, you know, I had to base this, you know, preliminary revenue impact on.
My question, Mr. Chairman, then is these types of contributions more prominent in low economic times than high economic times because claiming the tax credit?
Chairman Deckard and Senator Hannon. I think one thing that, you know, obviously I think they all three testified to is the fact that we have seen recently, you know, the push to have stronger engineering programs in the state. And so that is really going to spearhead them then to try to solicit some of these private donations. And so this is such that this credit may get used more in the future here than what we have seen in the past. And the past is really what I was basing this revenue impact on.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to get to is at the same time corporations such as an Intel lays off, I don't know, several hundred or thousand employees and then turns around and takes a tax credit during the same time, the question I have is, are we we're looking for resources, we're not looking to give away resources. One of our problems we have in this legislative assembly is if you look at existing statutes, we give far more back in tax credits than we actually receive in tax revenues. And I'm trying to find out if there is, and let me ask Mr. Craven on this, would your industry be inclined to support some modified version of this in exchange for having this for, you're looking at receiving it for the next 7 years under this proviso. It goes to 2010, as I understand it. Would you be willing to accept some modified version? Because, quite frankly, Mr. Craven, we're looking for revenue. We're not looking to give things away. If this was a good economic time, I'd say, fine, let's give it away. But this is a time we have to be a little bit of self-serving. At the same time, we're cutting higher education. Here's higher education saying give away some more money for it. So I understand the need for donations, and certainly I'm sympathetic to that, but would the industry be willing to accept some modified version of this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, we'll certainly take a look at any, I don't have a suggested modification, but we'll certainly work with the committee on any suggestions you might have. I think just two quick comments and follow-up. We certainly don't give away more in tax credits to our industry than our industry generates in tax revenue to the state of Oregon. I know your point is at the macro level in the whole tax expenditure report, I think is what you're referring to. It also, I think there's part of the low show up of usage of this credit does reflect bad economic times in terms of, I mean, as we all know that, you know, credit has very little value at a time when you may perhaps not have net taxable income. At such time, you don't use a credit, you can't take advantage of it. But we'll certainly look at, you know, whatever suggestions the committee might have. I would just say on this specific issue is that the value proposition to the state, I think, can be argued is totally to the plus in the sense of if a company donates $1 million piece of equipment and takes no credit, then obviously the state's $1 million to the plus. If they donate $1 million piece of equipment and avail themselves of $100,000 tax credit, the state's still $900,000 to the plus, and you could argue that the state has gained by that contribution if this became a critical part in those negotiations to incent a contribution. But we'd certainly be willing to look at, you know, any suggestions or possible modifications to the program.
Thank you.
Sir Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I have just a couple questions. The Mr. Cravens, do you have a kind of a roll-up number that you can share with the committee about how much this has created in value since the credit was offered for the first time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, I don't know that I have a total a dollar to put on it. As your staff has found, the difficulty of actually costing out the revenue impact is we could get a pretty good ballpark of the contributions made to our institutions. I mean, these deans keep track of such things. But linking each one of those contributions with whether a company took advantage of it as a deduction or took a credit or carry forward the credit for a couple of years, it's been difficult to get that precise data on the usage.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, this in sensitivity to Senator Hannon's questions, this isn't emptying the Gateway warehouse in Springfield, for instance, is it? I mean, this isn't just a mechanism for corporations to dump stuff they can't sell anyway, is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, I don't think from the testimony of the deans that there's been any indication of that. That these are very targeted, very specific contributions, such as the Credence contribution to equip a very brand new state-of-the-art laboratory, and they needed this one single thing to make that happen.
Mr. Chairman, I think that testimony to me is very convincing. First of all, the stuff has to be new. It must be current technology. If the institutions didn't get the donation and they had a need for the equipment, they'd have to buy it largely with public funds. And so it's a 10% tax credit. You've got a 90% leveraging there. But it's actually, I think, of greater value because if it's an absolutely critical component to complete a laboratory and you'd have to go out and buy the thing, you'd not only have lost the donation value, you'd have the expenditure as well. So this will always create a 9-to-1 value ratio for the state. I just think it's an excellent investment. So I'm sensitive to the idea that my colleagues have brought about these difficult times, and we should look at all tax credits, but on balance, this one stands scrutiny.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
I want to make sure the senator understands that we have over 200 tax credits in the state, and I would be willing to sign up for one more if I knew that the guts were there on the Republican side to raise revenue to balance the budget. But unfortunately, we have a lot of Republicans who are saying, I don't want to raise taxes, but I don't want to cut budgets. But yet you want to give away the farm. I would submit you can't have it both ways.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond.
Of course.
I don't have a fever either.
You two want to take this outside?
Jim, Chairman, would you like to get in on
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Farrelly.
I think Senator Hannon's exactly right. I think we're all going to face the time when we have to drop the ideology and the rhetoric and face the music. So I gather that those of us on the Revenue Committee will get that opportunity before the session's over.
You're getting this on tape?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your consideration, and we understand that any of these provisions are going to be part of these broader discussions, and we certainly understand that, and our job is to come up and make the case for this specific issue, and then your job is to resolve all this in the big picture, so we appreciate the time.
One question that I had is on the Credence investment, just as a good example, did you mark the credit that we had to Credence, or did Credence come to you seeking to make the donation?
No, we sought this out based upon one of our faculty members visiting with the National Science Foundation, which said that the number one thing that was needed was a testing laboratory at a university, and so we pursued this, pursued the company as well as the concept and the vision of the laboratory, particularly with the remote access portion of it.
Thank you.
But I also think this bill is a recognition of the state of importance of having an industry university legislative partnership, and that recognition is very important to us all. So thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You were the first tax credit we've heard all sessions, so we're going to hear four or five today. But you had the lead off, and I appreciate.
Thank you for
you hearing
allowing us to go first.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Good and bad.
You sure it wasn't No New Texas, Mr. Chair?
Bob Dryden might.
I misspelled it.
We will. Anyone else? 292. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 292. Like to open a work session on Senate Bill 819. Let's do that. Open a work session on Senate Bill 819.
Mr. Chairman?
You trying to get us down to two committee members again?
Senator Hannon, we are recalling this bill.
I would move that we recall Senate Bill 819 that was sent out of the committee with a due pass recommendation and vote to return it back to committee.
Senator Hannon has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 819. Those who believe that the rules should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 819 vote aye. Those opposed, nay.
Mr. Chairman, is that objection?
Tara, who is back and healthy with us, please call the roll.
Senator Sarkin?
Aye.
Hammond?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Rules have been suspended.
Mr. Chairman, I would now move that we reconsider the vote by which 819 was sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Hannon has moved that we reconsider the vote by which 819 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I want the committee and the public to know that I do support 819, but I did not support it rushing out as rapidly as it gained feet and moved out of the committee. I would like to look at the broader issue of rural schools and timber-dependent school districts. It's my understanding, Senator Corcoran is working on some language along with Senator Farrelly, and hopefully within a week to 10 days at the outside to meet the April 11th guidelines of the leadership. I'd like to have a final resolution on this. Failing that, I will support 819 out of committee and urge its passage.
Thank you. Any further discussion on Senate Bill 819? Those opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 819 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hannon. Motion passes. One more time. Do we have to do it one more time? Did we amend 819?
Yeah, you put in the small school exception for 4 years.
Well, let's just leave that there for now. Yeah. We'll just keep it there.
Committee has the bill. That's the best part.
We got the bill. Okay.
So we have Mr. Marquis help us with the
okay, good work.
Developing the rural school.
Thanks.
He's really cranky about the bill going out in the first place. Maybe we should have some help.
He's cranky, period.
Marquis is French for work group.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 415. Lizbeth.
Chairman Deckard and committee members, with Senate Bill 415, this is basically just allowing licensed naturopathic physicians to qualify for the rural physicians income tax credit. So basically right now in current law, you have an annual income tax credit for the continuation and establishment of medical practices in underserved rural areas of Oregon. And this credit is limited to $5,000 per practitioner, and it includes physicians, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, certified nurse anesthetist, podiatrists, dentists, optometrists. At least 60% of providers' practice must be spent in the qualified rural area in order to receive the credit. And then you have a listing there of what rural is according to the Office of Rural Health. And then as far as the people who have used this credit, it's primarily physicians. They create They are at 64% of the total. There's roughly about 20% that are nurse practitioners, and the rest are the smaller group of people. But basically, on average, most taxpayers claim about $4,650. There was over 900 taxpayers who claimed the credit in 2000. Now, the main thing I want to bring up with this bill, it's going to have a revenue reduction of approximately $382,976 in 2003-04, for a biennium of for 2003-05 of roughly $662,592. And with this credit, what I'm assuming here in the beginning, too, is that this begins tax year 2003, but please note that this bill really does not say, nowhere in here does it say what year this bill is applying to, what tax year. So really it would be very helpful to get an amendment to specifically say what tax year they would like this the licensed naturopathic physicians to qualify for, because if not, then, you know, when this just comes into law like this, then they could go in and amend back returns and stuff when it's not clear exactly what tax year. Most credit bills do have a tax year specified, but this one doesn't.
Thank you. There's one change we would
know. All right.
I noted that. We have others.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for bringing this bill to your committee. My name is Art Kyle, representing the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, and with me are two naturopathic physicians, Dr. Wayne Centrone on my left and Dr. Chris Melitis on my right. They'll speak in a few moments. We gave you a lot of materials, particularly because Senator Ferrioli wanted a lot of materials to see what naturopaths do, and so we gave all kinds of packets of material. As outlined by staff, 415 is a simple bill. It's designed strictly to encourage naturopathic physicians to practice in rural Oregon. The Association of Naturopathic Physicians has been discussing recently incentives to encourage naturopaths to settle in rural Oregon and practice in that area, as opposed to the majority who settle in the metropolitan area. Senators, the first part, in February of this year, the Office of Rural Health made several presentations to the Human Resources Committee, both in the Senate and the House, to discuss rural health. And they define rural health as any town that is 10 miles from a 30,000 population city, which those cities end up being Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, and Bend, and everything else is rural Oregon. And I think the fiscal impact that staff has described would encompass all those other communities, of which there are 78 naturopaths practicing in rural Oregon. Since discussing this issue with the Office of Rural Health yesterday, as a matter of fact, taking the suggestion of Karen Whitaker, who is the director of the program, she suggested that maybe we should consider only going to the towns of 5,000 population and below, which would reduce the fiscal impact from 78 practitioners at the present time to 11. We do have practitioners in all of these communities, but it would make a substantial impact on that, and I think we would be more than willing to amend the bill to include that provision as well as the other one that staff just brought up. As I mentioned, we do have practitioners in Canby and Madras, St. Helens, Seaside, Newport, Newburgh, and so on, some of the smaller communities, and we want to foster that. As was outlined, the present statutes include MDs, physical assistants, nurse practitioners, podiatrists, optometrists, and dentists. And the dentists and the optometrists are set aside only to those communities of 5,000 people and below. So we're more than happy to become involved in that. Why have naturopaths never been included in this? Because it has never seemed to the Department of Rural Health until this time that naturopaths would be included. Often opponents would criticize us in this program by saying there's no place for naturopaths in rural Oregon, it's too costly, and they don't have the proper education, which is the reason I mentioned that I brought these gentlemen to explain the training of naturopathic physicians. So I think, Mr. Chairman, I'll give Dr. Malise a chance to explain what the academic requirements and training requirements are for a naturopathic physician, and then be happy to answer questions that may come up.
Thank you.
Dr. Malise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senators. I'm actually the Dean of Naturopathic Medicine and Chief Medical Officer at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine. I will be going along off this piece of paper, the training of primary care physicians, which you should have in front of you. There's currently 5 naturopathic medical schools in North America: Bastyr University, Bridgeport University, the Canadian College in Toronto, National College of Naturopathic Medicine, which is actually the oldest naturopathic medical school in North America, Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine as well. Our students are required to have pre-med requirements, just as with any other type of physician, whether that be MD or DO. And the GPA requirements to enter our program are identical and are within the normal range for MD and DO programs. So the prerequisites are the same, the physics, the organic chemistry, and all the hard sciences. The duration of our program is 4 years long, very similar to MD and DO programs, and it's post-baccalaureate. We have 2 phases of our program, just like DO and MD programs. The first are the preclinical years, which are the first 2 years. We spend a lot of time sitting on a chair, listening to lecturers drone on and on about anatomy and physiology, pathology, microbiology, and biochemistry. I still remember those days. Then we go into our clinical years, which are 3rd and 4th years. Once again, same as with MD and DO programs, the 3rd and 4th years are when rotations begin. However, unlike the MD and DO model, we do not currently have residency programs that are required, except in the state of Utah. In the state of Oregon, it's not a requirement, so we're primary care physicians the moment we graduate. So as a result, in our curriculum, we emphasize outpatient care. In fact, our 4th-year students actually deliver direct patient care under the supervision of a faculty member to a minimum of 200 patients, but they experience in their years prior to that hundreds of patient contacts in the more observation roles, which is more similar to the MD or DO model. But of course, the MD and DO model counts more in residencies to get the hands-on experience, which we emphasize that early on. We actually have several outcomes measures for our program. We have a national board exams, basic sciences, as well as clinical board exams. These exams are very similar to conventional medical boards, with basic science boards at the first 2 years and then clinical boards after graduation. In order to practice in the state of Oregon, they have to prove competency at this level on a national board exam level. We also have throughout our program what we call GPA 1, 2, and 3, which are graduate proficiency assessments to enter the clinic, to progress through the clinic, and then to exit our clinic. And at this time of year, our students are eager to leave the program, and they've just finished their GPA 3s. Some passed, some did not pass. And those either get remediated or they get moved on. So once again, we have very clear, defined quality of outcomes. We also are under accreditation. We're actually candidates right now for Northwest Regional Accreditation, the same accrediting body which accredits Oregon Health Science University, Oregon State, Portland State, and they hold us to certain standards. We also, of course, have our specialty accreditation through our Council of Naturopathic Medical Examiners, once again upholding certain very clear standards, very similar to medical and chiropractic. Our scope of training is very broad. Some might argue we're the broadest trained physicians in the country. We have diagnostic therapeutics which are comparable and identical to MDs. We do full physical exams, just annual exams, male, female. We also do conventional testing, blood work, chemistry panels, CBCs, strep tests, pregnancy tests, you name it, we do it. We also do routine diagnostic imaging, CT scans, MRIs, x-rays, etc. In fact, I've diagnosed my share of things which have been missed by other practitioners. Therapeutically, we have a very broad formulary which is enclosed in the yellow sheets within your document. We have some 300 conventional drugs which we prescribe on a routine basis. If someone comes in with bronchitis or pneumonia, we can prescribe amoxicillin, Augmentin, a Z-Pak. If someone comes in and they want oral contraception, likewise. We're also federally recognized by the Drug Enforcement Administration. We have DEA numbers, just as MDs and DOs do. So our scope of practice and our training are identical. And on a closing note, for my testimony, I sit on the OHSU CAM curriculum committee as a principal investigator, actually looking at their curriculum and infusing natural medicine into the curriculum. So I'm very well versed with their curriculum as well, and we're very comparable in that regard as well.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Art, with your amendment in terms of 5,000 citizens or less, that would bring the fiscal down to 50 or 55,000 on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it would.
And are you aware, are there folks that are practicing naturopaths who live in these cities already that would just simply claim? Because my intent, and even considering this, would be that we would incent folks to go out to these smaller communities. So if they're actually there, then...
In the present bill as it stands today, it would give the incentive to 11 naturopaths who are practicing. This is Karen Whitaker's.
In cities that are 5,000 or less.
That's correct.
So I guess my question is, then what problem are we solving if there are already naturopaths in smaller cities? We'd have to do this prospectively.
I think our intention was to talk about the students that Dr. Melitus was talking that's graduating. What our hope was is to get two or three every year who graduate from the college here to go to John Day or Madras or Vail or someplace like that, halfway Oregon, to practice. As all the other practitioners that are in place under the rural health program today, all of them receive the tax credit who wish to apply throughout the state. So this merely puts the naturopathic physicians in the same categories as the MDs, the EOs, the podiatrists, the optometrists, the dentists, and all the rest.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a brief testimony?
Yes, I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having us here. Thank you, Senators. My testimony is really just to give you a gestalt or an overview, if you will, of the practice of naturopathic physicians. I happen to find myself in a unique situation in that I'm at a clinic for homeless youth in downtown Portland. My position there is actually funded by a grant from the Bureau of Primary Health Care, which is a federal agency run through HRSA, or the Human Resources Services Administration. And my role has really been in providing services to underserved populations. We, as an institution, National College of Naturopathic Medicine, attempt to provide our students with an opportunity to learn about rural health care. And I run a program that brings students to Latin America and have for the last 8 years. I work in Peru in some of the most underserved regions of Peru, where some of the participants in our clinics have never seen a clinician. So our students are really invited to be a part of underserved medicine. And this sets the stage for them wanting to work in underserved areas. However, the need for an incentive or a program that would attach them to underserved communities is very enticing. And we're here today to ask you to look into an incentive program that would allow us to take our physicians and put them into underserved areas so that they can serve the citizens of the state of Oregon. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. I would, Senator Hannon, do you have any questions or comments?
Only to say, Mr. Chairman, I understand and I can appreciate what the doctors are certainly trying to do. I can recall back, I shouldn't say many years ago, several years ago, when physicians' assistants came in and said, we want this only to pertain to those doctors' offices east of the Cascade Summit. And the legislature enacted it and gave physicians' assistants the ability to go under a supervision of a medical doctor to work in rural Oregon east of the Cascade Summit. Then they came back in and said, well, we got rural communities in the west side of the Cascade Summit. Well, Medford isn't exactly a rural community, and what they did, they wound up doing that medical doctors used physicians' assistants to do the early screening of the patients and turn around and bill the insurance company as if the doctor had seen the patient. And so these tax credits for optometrists or anybody else, quite frankly, I would just soon repeal them because it hasn't achieved under federal health policies, there are incentives to go into rural communities. And I would say that $50,000 is not a great deal, but $50,000 here and $50,000 there for the electronics industry and $50,000 for somebody else, and pretty soon, as Everett Dirksen once said,
real money.
It is real money.
Right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and respond to Senator Hannon, it is different from the from the programs of the other practitioners, the nurse practitioners and so on, because these people are actually primary care physicians, same category as the MDs, and they're practicing, and they're not asking to be on only one side of the mountain. We're asking to be only in the smallest communities that the state has to offer, and Medford is one of the larger ones.
Art, I know, Mr. Chairman, I know there was a survey once on rural health out of OHSU, and they did a survey in Eastern Oregon of primary care physicians for people in Eastern Oregon, and 18% said their veterinarian was their primary care physician in Eastern Oregon.
Yeah, we probably want to change that, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
We don't want to say that.
Yeah. Yes, Senator Schrader.
Yeah.
I've thought of three things I could say.
He's an exception.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, one thing which naturopaths don't currently enjoy is the ability to have federal rural dollars allocated towards us. We cannot participate as of yet in those funds. So having a state-funded system or credit would allow us to access and, you know, encourage students recently graduating with $100,000 with a debt load to go into rural areas, which otherwise they might not otherwise be able to do. So it would be a big benefit. And our whole motivation is purely patient care. And we appreciate the veterinarian care that's being delivered currently.
So I think what we should do, just to keep this alive, although it's just a almost impossible tax credit environment that you've heard that we're operating in because of the state budget, is get that fiscal down to 50 by doing it to 5,000, make it prospective so there would be any new naturopath, and that'll at least keep you in the hopper of having a chance. Appreciate the work that y'all do. My wife swears by naturopaths, and so I certainly hear great things about the work that you do.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll talk about that.
Thank you.
That issue. Thank you very much.
Not this guy. Close the public hearing on that bill. Which one was that? 415.
415.
Open. You're on 492. Public hearing on Senate Bill 492. Senator Devlin, come face the questions.
Come face the garlic.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 492. The purpose of this bill is to create a tax credit that applies to the principal paid on student loans. The student loans includes all student loans from all sources that are incurred for higher education expenses for the benefit of the taxpayer's spouse, or the taxpayer's dependent. The bill would allow for a credit in the amount that is the lesser of 10% of the principal paid in a year, or $150. According to the American Council on Education in 1999-2000 national study, the median amount borrowed in student loans to receive a bachelor's degree from a public four-year institution is $15,375. The average amount of loans for a student that attends a private four-year institution is $17,250. On average, 60% of students from public institutions and 67% of students from private institutions have some type of student loans. Between 1990 and 2000, student loan volume rose from $16.4 billion to $37.5 billion, and the number of loans made annually rose from 4.5 million loans to 9.4 million loans. This increase in student borrowing was fueled by legislative changes enacted earlier in the last decade. In 1992, the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, Congress broadened eligibility for subsidized federal student loans, raised annual limits, and created a new unsubsidized student loan program open to all students regardless of income. As a result of these changes, the annual student loan volume has increased significantly. Today, more students are able to attend college, but more students are incurring debt at a very young age and at very high levels. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the average annual income of all bachelor's degree recipients, probably not in Oregon, between the ages of 18 and 24, was $32,100 in the year 2000. Thus, the average monthly gross income was $2,675. and the monthly payment on a medium loan amount was $179 if the party had attended a public institution and $200 if the party had attended a private institution. I thought I'd use a fairly real example, so we took the example of a teacher in Oregon, a new teacher in the year 2000. The average salary for a new teacher in the state of Oregon in the year 2000 was $29,733. That's $2,477.75 per month. If you deduct from that $1,843.45 in Social Security taxes, $431.13 in Medicare taxes, $2,884 in federal taxes, and $2,133 in state taxes.
Sure.
Senator Starr.
I think that the senator from Tualatin should have more figures in his testimony.
Probably should. But
I'd like to see him at least read them rather than cite them verbatim.
Are those actually sound numbers?
Those are sound numbers. Those are based on an assumption of the party being single with one exemption, standard deduction, and $831.52 in student loan interest. That leaves them with a net of about $1,870 a month. Now, if they had the average for a private school at that time, which I think the average in Oregon is considerably higher than this, of $17,250 in loans on a 10-year amortized loan at a 5% rate, which is about the current APR rate, but it's a variable rate in reality, and many of those could go up to 7 or 8, 8.25%, their payment would be about $183 a month. So their net take-home would be about $1,687 a month, from which they would have to pay for all of their needs. Now, what this simply does is provide some incentive to pay off their loans timely and to get some modest credit for principal. In that type of a loan in the first year, the interest would be about $831, and the principal would be about $1,364. Thus, under this bill, should it pass, the credit to the party would be about $136.40. Mr. Chairman, I presented this bill.
Mr. Chair, can the witness please repeat the numbers?
I can. I don't even have to look at the sheet, actually.
That's what I was afraid of.
Committee, I learned today that Senator Devlin consumes 12 cups of coffee a day. I don't know if you'd like to comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, if you were to put a tax on Starbucks, and I'm not recommending that, I could pay probably at least $100 a year, even at 5 cents a cup.
Duly noted.
But what I was trying to emphasize in this bill, and I did present it in one earlier session, and this is maybe no offense to any members of the committee, but this maybe appears to some people, the Republican coming out in me, is sometimes I don't think we realize actually just how heavily taxed our new people that are coming into the economy are, and how much they actually lose in terms of all of the taxes that they have to pay. And when we look at these starting incomes, that $29,000 for a starting teacher is not a great income, but actually $29,000 is slightly higher than the average income of an Oregonian in this state, you know, for everyone that is employed. And for someone that is single and someone that is in normal circumstances, and to some extent because we've never adjusted the standard deduction in the state for many years, and we converted over from an exemption deduction to an exemption credit that is now not reflective even on any par even close to what the federal exemption credit is, people that are in this category are paying relatively high portions of their income in taxes. And I just thought this might be some incentive for them to pay student loans off and some incentive for some recognition of the cost of going to school today. And as the chairman knows, we used to have a philosophy in this state, I wouldn't call it an adopted philosophy, of higher tuition and high aid. Our problem right now is we're going to higher tuition with lower aid.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Would this program apply in the event that it was a family member who was the payer of the loan or was responsible for the loan, not the recipient of the
as the bill
education?
Sorry, Senator Starr. Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, as the bill is written, it would. Just as the federal deduction for interest applies. And I should say, just to be fair and upfront, because we consider adjusted gross income to be the adjusted gross income the federal government has, They do have their income adjusted for the interest in terms of their state income taxes also.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator, one of the challenges we put out, and we gave you some grief, but this is a very obviously laudable goal that you have in mind. One of the challenges that we put out there as a committee to folks who are interested in new tax credits is to find, to make it revenue neutral, is to bring back to us a credit or exemption that would be as a lower priority than this one that we might zero out or be able to proportionally cut. So I just put that challenge to you. I think that would be one way to really bring this issue squarely back before this committee, which I think is a laudable proposal, is to bring, make it revenue neutral and bring us something that would offset the cost.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, give me about 10 days and I'll bring you back such a credit.
Okay. It's a deal. Thank you
very much.
Appreciate it. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 492. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 798. Lizbeth and
committee members, with Senate Bill 798, this establishes a new state income tax credit for teachers for any expenses that are incurred in the tax year for purchases of educational supplies. It allows teachers who are instructing public K through 12 students or homeschool students to claim the subtraction. It is going to then restrict the educational expenses to be either claimed either as a federal or a state subtraction. It's going to limit that subtraction to be non-refundable and not carried forward for subsequent tax years. Now, basically, in current law, we had beginning tax year 2002 that the federal government had provided an above-the-line personal income tax subtraction for gross income for educators for the expenses paid for the purchase of any books and classroom supplies. Now, the purpose of that subtraction was to basically reimburse teachers and other school professionals for the expenses they were incurring related to classroom activities. And then the deduction is available for an educator in a public or private elementary or secondary school. To be eligible, then the taxpayer had to work at least 900 hours during the school year as a teacher, instructor, counselor, principal, or aide. Now, the thing is that in federal law right now, the educator can subtract up to $250 of qualified expenses paid or incurred in the tax year beginning 2002. It's allowing an additional subtraction beyond the $250. So that's the main thing, is there isn't a limit now on how much you could get as a deduction in Oregon for the expenses that you would incur. Now, I did not do a revenue impact on this. So it's very hard to get at these expenses that would actually be incurred by teachers. There have been some estimates done at the federal level when they were considering recently in the Bush plan of increasing that above-the-line tax subtraction for teachers' costs. And in that case, if you would portion out in that proposal, they were going to increase it from $250 under current law to $400, so increases another $150. If you did that kind of a scenario and then you portioned out Oregon's portion of the national estimates, it would be roughly about an 03-05 biennium, about $615,000, going up to about $1.6 million in the 05-07 biennium. But this really is even broader as far as who could actually qualify under Senate Bill 798 than what even federal statutes allow, because it is allowing their, like homeschoolers and stuff, the teachers of homeschoolers to have that credit and then that deduction. And so then that deduction would not be claimed at all at the federal level, just in Oregon.
Thank you. You must be Mr. Eaton.
Yes.
I would just like to introduce Mr. Eaton on behalf of Senator Clarno, and Senator Clarno supports Senate Bill 798, I'm just going to turn everything over to Mr. Eaton for his testimony, and thank you for hearing the bill.
Chairman Decker and members of the committee,
like to thank you for your time here and allowing me to testify. The reasons for proposing this tax credit is that I believe education is very important, and teachers are, of course, the front line in providing the education for our students. And it's something there's I know public schools teachers and some homeschooler teachers that are always looking for ways to find ways to get the best educational material available to help teach their students. I propose this legislation as a means of helping because there's a shortfall that classrooms and teachers are having a hard time getting money, and this would be a way of that if they have some extra money and that they can find legitimate education material to pick up themselves and use that in the classroom, that would be a way of encouraging them to do so.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I'm in favor of this bill, of course, because I proposed it. I'm a little concerned about subsection 2 of section 2 because it excludes parochial school teachers. The Supreme Court ruled in Cotterman and versus Killian that Cleveland's educational vouchers are constitutional because the money is going direct to parents. The tax credit I'm proposing would go direct to teachers, and where they it's free. It's their free choice to where they go, whether it's a secular institution or a parochial institution. And also in Davey versus Locke, the Ninth Circuit of Court of Appeals ruled that a Washington student couldn't be excluded from state-funded scholarships because, again, he was choosing to spend that money on religious instruction as opposed to something else. And also, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that state's voluntary tuition tax credit to be constitutional because, again, it doesn't require that it be spent on religious schools, but the parents can choose it.
Chair, member of the committee, members of the committee, I don't believe I stated my name for the record, but for the record, Sean Cleave. I'd just like to point out that we've included a copy of Arizona's similar tax credit law, and that can be used at your discretion. And again, I'd like to thank the committee and you, Senator Deckert, for hearing this bill. I know there's difficult times in Oregon, and obviously from the discussions from the prior bills, weighing these types of credits is a high priority for you as legislators. So again, I'd just like to thank you, and thank you for hearing Mr. Eaton's testimony.
Thank you.
We should probably, Mr. Eaton, we probably should get your name for the record also.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is David Eaton. I'm just a concerned citizen.
Not just.
I don't belong to any advocate group.
This is and I would agree with you, we would want to do this across the board. We know, I think all the members of the committee are aware of the considerable amount of money all teachers, private, public, home, put into the education materials out of pocket. It is an issue. We can work with Senator Clarno's office. Any idea, obviously, as we said previously, would probably have to come in a revenue-neutral manner, which would mean finding less of a priority that's on the books that we could take off and replace with this one. But appreciate the intent.
Wonder, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I know that Elizabeth said this is difficult to judge what kind of impact, fiscal impact this would have. I wonder if it would be possible to just put a cap, say, $5 million cap, and then however many folks applied for the credit, it'd be a pro rata kind of credit available, and kind of see what kind of support would be out there. And that way we'd at least have a target that you could go after to find, how to make that revenue neutral. If you put a cap here, then where you kind of give you a target to look for. might be an option. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in this. I mean, yeah. Do you think this would be something that's worthy of exploration and trying to find a way to make happen?
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, can you do that? Can you put the cap and get the first ones in? Or
Senator Deckard and Senator Starr, I think the easiest way also would be to consider kind of like what the federal government was trying to do recently with just expanding the credit that they have. I mean, right now it's set at $250. Now, that comes through also to Oregon through our Oregon income taxes also. So you could set it and say you could have an additional $200 or something here in Oregon as an deduction. So, I mean, that's another way of looking at it.
So we should be able to, Mr. Chair, should be able to identify the number of Oregonians who are taking advantage of the federal credit, I would guess. Shouldn't we be able to?
Yeah, Senator Starr, we can, but that starts in 2002, see, and recent data is really preliminary 2001 data, unfortunately, we just don't have it yet.
I see, okay.
So we will know a lot more in 2002 once this federal one kicks in, which in some ways will help, Mr. Eaton, because it'll give us who that world is and give us some data to work with. But I'm encouraged by what Senator Starr, maybe Senator Clarno, in terms of creativity. Mm-hmm. Maybe we wait till 2002 and we just see what the federal program provides us. Mm-hmm. But there are opportunities to be creative with how you structure this and finding others that you might phase out.
And certainly I'd be willing to accept, you know, a smaller deduction as well.
Right. Anything else? Appreciate it.
Thank you
for your time. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 798. We got anything else? Oh, we don't have you on the list, but we're more than happy to reopen. You're Marcia. Marcia, you were on the list. Reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 798. My apologies for
that's okay.
Not reading your name. Ms. Kelly.
My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition, but I'm wearing my hat for the Revenue Coalition today, and I have the testimony, and we are in opposition to this bill because it is a new tax credit. And basically attached to it, double-sided so that it saves money, are what $1 million will buy and criteria for assessing tax credits. And while this may sort of help education, it's sort of our feeling that it would be better to fund schools at the level that they should be funded so that teachers are not having to pay out of their pockets for expenses for the classroom. And so as you give credits like this, and then teachers are expected to expend more and more, it's really actually more of a deduction out of their pocket. And so we don't want any more new tax credits that cannot really be justified. And for your calculations, I checked with the one of the lobbyists for the Oregon Education Association. There are approximately 45,000 teachers in Oregon.
Appreciate it. And you heard the discussion centering around offsetting maybe existing ones versus
yeah, the position of the Revenue Coalition was not offsetting, was opposition. The prior two bills, we did submit two of the three prior bills, we submitted testimony, and that was offset. We just wanted to oppose this one.
Thanks.
35,000, Mr. Chair, is only public schools, I guess.
45,000.
45,000, but that's public schools.
Yeah.
This bill is much broader than that.
Yeah, it's broad. Yeah. Homeschoolers, parochial schools, aides, principals. You know, if we're talking about classroom materials, we really should be talking about funding that by looking at all of the other money we're giving away. And I, too, Senator Hannon, am a Republican and believe in limiting some of these credits.
Thank you. This has been a great day for Republicans, I got to say, Senator.
I'm sitting on the right.
Far right.
Far right.
Yeah.
Anything further on 798? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 798. That is all we have today, committee.
If we do set data,
yeah, got that one back. if anyone else has tax credits, this is the only tax credits we have scheduled.
Not going to get out.
Okay, so that's all we have. If other folks have them, today was really the day. You can get them to myself or Mr. Warner, and we would consider, but this was really our day to listen to tax credits that people wanted hearings on. So if there are more out there, get to me or
too late to I have Mr. one Warner. For the Irish, portly, short Irish guys that Senator Hann and I are working on.
Mr. Chairman?
The revenue impact wouldn't be very high on that. I mean, it's probably a small universe of
short fat guy, Irish guys?
No, read lightly. Senator Hannon.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Warner if at some point in the next several days he might get a list to all the committee members. I was directed by my Senate President, Peter Courtney, to look at coming up with some additional revenue resources. And we have been looking at some possible ideas and suggestions. I'd like to consider that given to the committee members, but it would generate approximately in the area of about $800 million potential revenue from just existing tax credits. Mm-hmm. Doing an across-the-board 10% tax credit reduction and doing some minor things. All we have to do is do some minor things, and we can actually generate revenue from existing resources. And I think the time has come that tax credits are fine and well during good economic times. And I would probably support many of the proposals that were presented here for consideration today. But, you know, it's really hard to justify and explain to upper-income people why they get their tax credits, and down here we cut services to the needy and the most vulnerable. I just have a difficult time relating to those two. And we have a budget that was chopped on five times during five special sessions. And I'm not faulting my colleagues or chastising their integrity or reasons or logic or whatever, but I cannot justifiably look people in the eye and say, I'm prepared to put your program on the line and cut your program while at the same time turning around and giving a substantial tax credit to somebody else that benefits them at the expense of the people that are most vulnerable. Now, call me a Republican, call me a Democrat, call me whatever the hell you want, but at least I care about people.
Yeah.
And it just bothers me extremely much that we say to people, on one hand, I care about the poor, the most vulnerable, but yet I'm willing to give to those that can afford it the most. So.
Well,
no, I'm just giving my speech for the day, but I wish Mr. Warner would share that with the committee at some point, because I think it's very intriguing to look at what our potential is and what might have to, in fact, occur is the Senate may have to show some leadership by standing up and doing some of these proposals to get the attention of some of our House colleagues who are a little timid about talking about the revenue word. They talk about not cutting budgets, not cutting programs, but yet they can't say in the same voice, revenue.
Senator Hannon, I appreciate because I feel this first time, at least in my tenure, that the majority of folks echo those sentiments, which is, in my four terms here, that's the first time I've felt we've heard those comments before, but that now you have a majority of your colleagues that are willing to follow.
Well, the words are finally, unfortunately, sinking in because there are no alternatives. We have exercised the attitude of beg, borrow, and stealing from other programs in the state, and there is nothing to take. There is nothing left to extort. And what we have to do is look at things. What are we willing to give up? And in good times, I'm willing to share my distribution of wealth. But bad times, Oh, no, I can't share in that. Well, baloney. We're all in this boat together. We all share the pain, and the less we have, then we all step up and share that responsibility. Because that's what society responsibility is all about. Mm-hmm. And I believe in those things.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean I can have your Blazer tickets?
I got rid of them because I'm from the poor Republican.
That's an oxymoron.
We have been working on the issue Senator Hannon is discussing, and there are, of course, a number of technical issues, and we're working on those, and we'd be prepared to share that with the committee at any time. So we've been working with the Department of Revenue, for example, and others.
Great. Appreciate the work.
I think that might be something to look at for an informational meeting someday to be held for the committee members.
Yeah, we know that's coming. I mean, that work is coming. I'm open to committee members' suggestion when we get to. We certainly know that issue, as soon as this budget comes out in about 2 weeks, then our work really
begins.
And I'm open when we schedule that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. We're adjourned.